So you can go ahead and open up your Bibles to Genesis chapter 18. We'll be looking at Genesis 18 and part of 19 today. Now, one of the very first Broadway shows that I ever saw was this little known one called Les Miserables. And it's based on a very long book. By the way, I don't speak French, so I'm just sort of doing my best at that. It's based on a very long book that was written back in 1862 by a French author named Victor Hugo. And in the story, this, by the way, is not from the Broadway show, this is from the movie. In the story, the main character is Jean Valjean. And Jean Valjean, at the beginning of the story, we learn, has stolen a loaf of bread to feed his sister's starving child. And he's then arrested and he's sentenced to 5 years in prison. Now, he tries to escape a couple times, gets more. And so when it's all said and done, he's spent 19 years in prison before he's paroled. And part of that parole means that he must take his papers with him wherever he goes and show that to people as he goes to different from place to place. And that then makes it very difficult for him to do anything because everyone sees him as a convict. And so Jean Valjean eventually breaks parole and disappears for a while near the beginning of the story. Now, on the other hand, there's this police officer who paroled him, and his name is Inspector Javert. And he is this interesting character where he's very focused, extremely focused on the law. So in a way, he's not necessarily a bad guy. He's just very focused on what is right to him. And so when Valjean disappears, Javert goes after him for years and years. So Javert does not know or seem to know what the word mercy means. And so all he wants is to bring Jean Valjean, this man who has broken the law, to justice. Now, since the book is only 163 years old, and you may not have had a chance to read it yet, I'm not going to give it away what happens at the end. But as I thought about the passage that we're going to be looking at today, Inspector Javert came to my mind. Because in one way, what we're going to see is an Inspector Javert situation where God is going to carry out judgment on a sinful people. But then the story goes very different, because at the same time that God is judging, we're going to see a God who's very different than Javert, because as God is carrying out the judgment, he's also showing amazing mercy. And so by the end of our passage, near halfway through chapter 19, I hope that you're going to get a better understanding of the God who judges, but also the God who shows mercy. And this mix should have an impact on how you live. And so I'm going to begin by just sort of walking through the chapters, and then we'll talk about the two main parts of it, the judgment side and the mercy side. And so let's go ahead and let's look at Genesis 18, verse 1. So, and the Lord appeared to him being Abraham, by the oaks of Mamre, and he sat at the door of his tent in the heat of the day. And he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing in front of him. And when he saw them, he ran to the tent door to meet them. Now, do you remember what happened back in chapter 17, just in the previous chapter? So God made a covenant with Abraham, but then what happened after that? There was that little awkward time where God then told them to get circumcised. And so Abraham had just been circumcised. He had just gone through a recent adult circumcision. He's there resting under the tree when these three people appear to him. And so up walks these three men. And in verse 1, we see that one of them is the Lord, is God. In the next chapter, we learn that the other two are angels. And so this is what's called a theophany, where God is making himself visible to the human senses. And it's not clear if right at that moment Abraham knows that it's God, but pretty soon He's going to find out. So it's possible he's just being very hospitable. But pretty soon, as I said, he will find out that it's God. And so in the next couple of verses, Abraham begs them to stay for a meal. They finally relent and they agree. And then Abraham, I got a kick out of this, being the sacrificial person that he was, he then goes and tells his wife to quickly make a meal for them. Verse 6, let me read that. And Abraham went quickly into the tent of Sarah and said, "Quick, 3 seahs of fine flour, knead it, and make cakes." Very, very giving and sacrificial of you, Abraham, to do that. So Abraham does, though, then go and slaughter a calf. And while they're sitting there under the tree, probably having their meal at that point, they then tell Abraham that his wife is going to have a child within a year. This is no shock to Abraham. He's just been told that the previous chapter. But Sarah is very shocked. And so they go through this encounter where they say, yes, you're going to have a child. And then after lunch, in verse 16, it says, "Then the men set out from there, and they looked down toward Sodom. And Abraham went with them to set them on their way." Verse 20. "And then the Lord said, 'Because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and their sin is very grave, I will go down to see whether they have done altogether, according to the outcry that has come to me. And if not, I will know.'" So the implication here is that God is going to judge Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, we know all the way back in chapter 13 that Sodom is seen as a very wicked, sinful place. However, we also know from chapter 13 that that Abraham's nephew Lot had moved right into the city. And so, no doubt, Abraham's seeing what's about to take place and hearing it, and he's very concerned because he has family down there. And so instead of just trying to explain everything, I'm going to read a series of verses here, what takes place after this. Verse 22. "And so the men turned from there and went toward Sodom. But Abraham stood before the Lord." And so the two angels that were with the Lord, so the two of the three have walked down to Sodom. And so now it's got just Abraham and God. "Then Abraham drew near and said, 'Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you then sweep away the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to put the righteous to death with the wicked, so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be that from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just? And the Lord said, "If I find at Sodom 50 righteous in the city, I will spare the whole place for their sake." Abraham answered and said, "Behold, I've undertaken to speak to the Lord, I who am but dust and ashes. Suppose 5 of the 50 righteous are lacking. Will you destroy the whole city for lack of 5? And he said, "I will not destroy it if I find 45 there." And he spoke to him and said, "Suppose 40 are there." And he answered, "For the sake of 40, I will not do it." And then he said, "Oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak. Suppose 30 are found there." And he answered, "I will not do it if I find 30 there." And he said, "Behold, I've undertaken to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there." And he answered, "For the sake of 20, I will not destroy it." And then he said, "Oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak again, but this once. Suppose 10 are found there." And he answered, "For the sake of 10, I will not destroy it." And the Lord went his way when he had finished speaking to Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. So what we see here is that Abraham interceded for Lot in Sodom. And so if just 10 righteous people are found in the city of Sodom, that whole city will be spared. And if you think about it, if just Lot and his family and one or two others are righteous or found righteous, then that entire city would be spared. But sadly, not even 10 can be found. So I'll talk more about the intercession in a moment. So beginning in chapter 19, the scene then shifts to Sodom, where now you remember that the two angels left, and so they've now made their way into the middle of the city. And Lot now sees them, and he insists that they come stay with him instead of sleeping out in the town square. And he does this because he knows of the sinfulness of the town, the city that he lives in, and he doesn't want these two travelers to be hurt. In fact, in 2 Peter 2:8, it says this of Lot, that he was tormenting his righteous soul over there, Sodom's lawless deeds that he saw and heard. So he knew what was going on in that city. So the angels go and eat with Lot in the house. And then sometime after dinner, before bedtime, this is what happens. Verse 4. But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man surrounded the house. And they called to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them." And Lot went out to the men at the entrance, shut the door after him, and said, "I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly." And so clearly, it's no. They're not wanting to just meet them. There's other references in Genesis to the word no, referring to sex. And so Lot then has this great idea to send his daughters out in the place of the strangers. So he said, "Hey, take my daughters instead." And thankfully for his daughters, they're only interested in the two male travelers. So this interaction continues to the point where the crowd is about to break down the door. Verse 10 says, "But then the men," this is the angels now, "reached out their hands and brought Lot back into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck with blindness the men who were at the entrance of the house, both small and great, so that they wore themselves out groping for the door." One pastor that I listened to this week thought that they probably weren't struck with complete blindness, like they couldn't see at all. They just couldn't see the house. So they were groping around looking for the door that had just disappeared. But either way, the angels have now taken control of the situation. Verse 12, "Then the men said to Lot, 'Have you anyone else here? Sons-in-law, sons, daughters, or anyone you have in the city, bring them out of the place. For we are about to destroy this place because of the outcry against its people has been great before the Lord. And the Lord has sent us to destroy it.' And so Lot went out and said to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, 'Get up, get out of this place, for the Lord is about to destroy the city.' But he seemed to his sons-in-law to be jesting." So it's now morning time. The angels tell Lot that he must leave now, but even then he delays. And so verse 16 says, "But he," Lot, "lingered." And so the men seized him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand, and the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him out and set him outside of the city. And so the angels literally drag them out of the city. Verse 24. "And then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. But Lot's wife behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt." And so God destroys the two cities. Says Lot's wife looked back. Most likely she probably turned back and went back in that direction. and was then killed by the fire that was raining down. And so that's as far as we're going to get in our passage in Genesis 19 today. And we've just read some pretty intense about some pretty intense situations about the judgment and mercy of God. And so I want to take now a few moments to talk about each part that we've looked about. So if you have in your bulletins, there's a teaching sheet where you can follow along with some of the main points of the message. And in the first part, I want to talk about the judgment of God. And so to begin, I want to ask the question, why were Sodom and Gomorrah judged? After all the cities around them were sinful, and so why were these two cities in particular? And we know it's because of sin, after all. The Lord said, because of the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and their sin is very grave. And so what is this grave sin? Now, for those of you who know the story, there, no doubt you've probably heard some people say that the sin that they're being judged for is the sin of homosexuality. After all, the very city gives us the term sodomy. But I want to propose to you that homosexuality was more of the fruit of another more basic sin. In fact, we learn about that in Ezekiel chapter 16. Which sheds light on this situation. So let me read those two verses. Behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride, excess of food, and prosperous ease, and did not aid the poor and needy. They were haughty and did an abomination before me, so I removed them when I saw it. So based on these verses, we get probably a broader perspective of what was going on. That Sodom was a prosperous city, but instead of using their prosperity to be a blessing to others, what do? They instead use it selfishly. So they became prideful. They became gluttonous, just sort of feeding their own desires instead of using what they were given to bless and to help those that were in need. But through all of this, they then turned to their inward sinful fleshly desires. And in this situation, it's homosexuality and beyond that, even rape, instead of being a blessing to help others out. And so it's not that God is just saying, oh no, they're practicing homosexuality, I'm going to wipe them out. That's not what's going on here. Homosexuality is just one of the sins that comes from a long line of other sins that's going on in the city. So to use a picture analogy here, if homosexuality were the leaves of the tree, then pride would be the roots, selfishness, the trunk, and gluttony, the branches. And so you can see that this is a slippery slope of sin here that they're getting themselves involved in. So the root sin of Sodom is pride. And this is a sin that we all struggle with. The problem is that if we let pride stay in ourselves and not get it out of our lives and not constantly try to battle us, it will take us down a path that we don't want to go. Now, I came across this video yesterday that I got a kick out of, and I think it perfectly illustrates sort of this slippery nature of sin. And so let's go ahead, let's take a look at this short video. And there is some entertaining audio here if you want to turn that on. Well, we see here that they made it so close to home, didn't they? And because of the ice, they're not even driving the wrong way. What are they doing? they're just slipping down the road there and ending up where they do not want to be. And listen, if you give it a foundation, if you give sin a foundation in your life, then it will grow and end up taking you places that you do not plan to go. Romans 1 is another example of this. And in the New Testament, in Romans 1, we see the slippery nature, the slippery slope of sin. And Paul, in this passage, lays out a line of sins that really just build off of each other. And so I'm going to read parts of that. In verse 18, Paul writes that, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth." And so the first sin that we really see here is that they know the truth of God, but they push it away. They suppress it. And so they suppress the truth of God. But then, verse 21, "For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools." And so, second sin that we see that builds off the first one, that there is pride and intentional ignorance of God's ways. Then continuing in verse 23, "Then they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man, and birds, and animals, and creeping things." So now we see the sin of idolatry. Verse 24, "Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their heart to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is to be blessed forever. For this reason, God gave them up to the dishonorable passions, for their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error." And so sin number four is what I call sexual perversion. And so in this situation, in the situation of Sodom, it's homosexuality, but really it could be, for other people, it could be other types of sexual perversion. So heterosexuals can certainly sin sexually in all sorts of different ways and disobey how God intends sex to be. Verse 28, "And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice, and they were full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them." Does that not sound like Sodom and Gomorrah? So sin number five, I would just put many others after that. All sorts of sin. So do you see the slippery slope of sin? That each one goes and builds to the next one. So if we let it, we are going to be tempted to suppress the truth of God in our life. And if we let that happen, we're going to be tempted to become prideful. And if we give in to that, we are all going to be tempted to turn to idolatry in some form. And then if we're left at that, then we're going to be tempted to use sex in a way that God did not intend. And then finally, if we're going to let that take place in our life, we're going to be tempted to just give in to a plethora of other sins as the hardness of our hearts continues. And so may we take sin seriously in our lives. I want to move on now to the mercy part. And as we've been asking every time in this series, as we go through Genesis, where is Christ in this passage? This is where the mercy part comes out. So I want to point out two instances that we see the mercy of God. There's others, but first of all, we see Lot and his family. They're delaying and delaying and delaying going out of the city. And so what do the angels finally do? Well, they literally grab them and yank them out of the city. And as I read that, I was thinking about how God does that at times in our own lives. For example, if you're saved, if you've put your faith in Jesus Christ, then how did you get to the point of wanting to be saved? It's not through your own smarts or thinking that you have deserved to be saved or thinking, oh, as a wicked person, I'm now going to come to Jesus. No, Ephesians says that in your wickedness, you were dead in your transgressions. And so God literally grabbed you out of the train headed for hell and took you and saved you. Other times, in other situations, you may be tempted to give in to a particular temptation. And if you do, it's going to radically transform or ruin your life. And so it's only through the mercy of God that you don't do it, that God intervenes and causes a situation to so that you don't give in to it. And so God's mercy is shown in all sorts of ways in our life. But there's a second way that I want to focus on for the rest of the time in our passage, and that is how God's mercy is shown through Abraham's intervention or intercession. So when Abraham learns about Lot being in Sodom and Sodom being judged, he starts out, he's like, God, if there's 50 righteous people in the city, will you spare it? God's like, I'll spare it. All right, God, what about 45? What about 40? What about 30? What about 20? What about 10? He's starting to sound like an auctioneer, right? I guess in the opposite direction. And God finally says, all right, I'll spare it for 10. You see, the intercession of Abraham that we see here gives us a powerful picture of Jesus' intercession for us. Let me give you a couple of verses. Hebrews 7. Consequently, he, Jesus, is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to what? To make intercession for them. That's what Jesus is doing for us. 1 John 2:1, my little children, I'm writing these things to you that you may not sin. But if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous. He is advocating for us. And then last, Romans 8:24. Who is to condemn? Christ Jesus is the one who died, more than that, who was raised, who is at the right hand of God, who indeed is interceding for us. And church, may we remember that we are in desperate need of Jesus' intercession. God destroyed the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah in a pretty intense, sort of crazy way. But the reality is that what we see in Sodom and Gomorrah is just a precursor of what is to come. Matthew 10:15, Jesus sends out his disciples to go and to tell the people about him. And he says this about those who reject the message of Jesus. He says, truly, I say to you, it will be more bearable on the day of judgment for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah than for that town. Are you catching here? That for those that reject Jesus Christ, it's going to be worse for them than for Sodom and Gomorrah. So when Jesus returns, the judgment of God for the unrighteous will be worse than Sodom. And Romans makes it clear that we are all unrighteous. Romans 3:9-31. And so we all need Jesus' intercession. And so the only reason that we can come here today and be happy and worship God, confident that we are not bound for hell for a worse fate than Sodom and Gomorrah, is because of what Jesus Christ did for us. So we receive mercy through Jesus Christ. Why? Because Jesus is the righteous one. As Abraham was saying, is there 50? Is there 45? Is there 40? And so on, all the way down to 10. Not even 10 were found in there. But Jesus is the one and final and ultimate righteous one that can step in and stop the judgment for those that follow him. So now, all who put their faith in him and believe in Jesus Christ are saved and are no longer judged, because the judgment goes upon Jesus Christ instead. 23 years ago, terrorists attacked the Twin Towers. They flew the planes into the north and to the south tower, and nearly 3,000 people died from those attacks. However, throughout that horrible incident, there were numerous amounts of bravery that came out. There's one man named Rick Rescorla, and he was a Vietnam vet, and he was the security director for Morgan Stanley. And he had long anticipated, I read, a possible attack on the World Trade Center, and so he regularly drilled the Morgan Stanley employees of evacuation procedures. And so Morgan Stanley was in the South Tower, and so when the first plane hit the North Tower, the New York Port Authority initially told everyone just to stay put, just to stay where they're at. But Rescorla ignored the directive and directed the 2,700 employees of Morgan Stanley to evacuate the South Tower. And so with a bullhorn in hand, he directed down the stairs, singing songs to them to keep them calm. And so after the evacuation, after those people left, he then went back up into the building to look for stragglers, and sadly, he never came out again. And this man gave his life to help others live. And those that followed him that day made it out alive. And from a spiritual perspective, Jesus gave his life so that others might live. And those that follow him will be saved from the judgment of God. And so I want to just quickly give you three questions to consider. First of all, have you given your life to Jesus Christ? So if not, I want to encourage you to turn to him today, because if you haven't, the judgment of God is on you. And the only reason that I can stand here and say the judgment of God is not on me is not because I'm some great guy, but because of Jesus Christ saving me. So give him your life. The Bible says that if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, that you will be saved. Second question: what sin do you need to stop? So are you on that slippery slope? And if so, because we're all there somewhere, but where do you need to stop and say no more and ask God for help to get that sin out of your life? And then third question I want to ask you: have you praised him today for his salvation? Because he has done an amazing thing in our lives by saving us. He went to the cross and died for us and then rose again, conquering death once and for all. And so now we stand here today saved because of what he's done. So have you praised him for that? Or have you just taken that for granted? So let me close with these words here from Luke 1. For he who is mighty has done great things for me. Worship team, you can come on up. And holy is his name. And his mercy is for those who fear him from generation to generation. That's Jesus. That's the one that we're worshiping today. So let's go ahead and let's spend a moment now in prayer.